It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly roundup of national political news from Russia to the Midwest. Harry Enten from 538.com weighs in on the latest.
First, President Barack Obama announced yesterday what he called a permanent ban on offshore oil and gas drilling along big areas of the Arctic and the Atlantic seaboards.
The president used a law from the 1950s to take this action. He said the law gives him authority to act unilaterally. Some pundits say President Obama's declaration of a permanent drilling ban along the Atlantic and Arctic coasts is unprecedented.
Nick Giuliano joins us now to talk about this executive action and how it could affect the future of energy in the United States. He's the deputy energy editor for Politico. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Veronica.
Well, Nick, how significant is this declaration from the president?
This is pretty significant. This is an authority that's been used a few times before, never quite to this extent. The administration says this is 115 million acres in the Arctic that's being taken off limits, and a little less than 4 million acres in the North and Mid-Atlantic. It's something that environmentalists have been asking him to do forever. It's as some commentators have noted, it's really a shift in his administration from what was once an all of the above energy posture to now really embrace the sort of keep it in the ground movement that's been animating environmental activists lately.
What justification did the president give for taking this action to protect these waters by law, not with an executive action even, but with a lasting law?
Sure. So, I mean, it was an executive action that he took using authority that has been, in place in this law, as you mentioned, that was passed initially in the 1950s. The president or the White House in the announcement said, there's not a whole lot of production that happens in these areas to begin with. It would take, several decades for new production to come online. And they say, that this is not necessary at, as the White House said yesterday, quote, at a time when we need to continue to move decisively away from fossil fuels. So, like I say, this is the commitment to doing something about climate change is what's animating him, and the belief that doing something about climate change means, explicitly moving away from fossil fuels.
And you mentioned the law that the president is using has been used before. What is it? What do we know about it?
So it's called the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. It's a big sweeping law that governs leasing of the Atlantic Ocean. He's using a small section of this law that basically says in essence, from time to time, a president may withdraw areas from leasing. And that's more or less all it says. It doesn't have any the key thing is there's no language in there that says, a future president may undo that decision and put these areas back sort of on the, on the potential auction block. So this is, something that goes beyond just the, periodic plans that the Interior Department puts out every 5 years saying, what areas are going to be up for lease and what aren't. It's sort of akin to, it's been being compared to declaring something a national monument, which the supporters of this move say, monument designations have been upheld as permanent and sort of more or less unable to be undone by future administrations. This legislation, the language in there is similar to the Antiquities Act, which governs, mostly monuments on land, and then therefore they think they can protect this from a Trump administration.
It sounds quite permanent. Does that mean that President Trump, President-elect at this point, Trump, couldn't come into office and find a mechanism to undo this through the courts somehow?
He's certainly expected to try. We're certainly expecting to see the lawsuits filed by industry groups trying to undo this, and Congress obviously could rewrite the law to put these places back in, make them available again.
What potential is there for energy in these areas that are protected? What have energy companies said about what could be there?
So the Arctic has been difficult to explore. Shell tried to do some operations there a few years ago. They ran into difficult weather, some problems with their equipment. They've since sort of pulled back on those plans. Oil companies say the Arctic overall has potentially rich resources. It's something that Russia is interested in exploring. Exxon has participated in some joint ventures with Russia that have received a lot of attention in the context of Rex Tillerson getting the Secretary of State nomination. Other countries along the Arctic Circle are potentially interested in this, but environmentalists will argue it's too difficult and not basically worth the effort given that the White House's view that we need to get away from fossil fuels to begin with.
We're talking right now with Nick Giuliano, Deputy Energy Editor for Politico, talking about President Obama's executive action, creating what the president calls a permanent ban on offshore gas and oil drilling along the Arctic and Atlantic seaboards. And what response has this gotten from environmentalists? You said this represents a kind of embrace of a keep-it-in-the-ground mentality. So what have environmentalists had to say today?
They've all been, you know, very, very happy to see this announcement come out. There's been some have said he should have gone even further, especially along the Atlantic. The areas off limits are basically a series of trenches from, you know, more or less New England to about the mid-Atlantic. You know, some environmental groups in South Carolina, I saw some coverage saying that he wish he would have gone a little bit further. But overall, they're very, very happy to see this announcement come out.
And specifically from the energy industry, some critics speaking out about this move. What have you heard?
Yeah, I mean, the oil industry is obviously not happy about this. They, you know, they're going to certainly fight this. They say that, they say that the president's assurances that this is permanent should not be just taken at face value. They think there are going to be ways to undo this, and they're certainly going to try and do so.
Do you expect to see other last-ditch efforts in the same arena of energy and environmental policy from the president before he leaves office? Not a lot of time left, but could we see something else like this?
Yeah, I mean, he's got about a month left in office, and he's certainly been keeping us busy. As I mentioned before, you know, he can declare national monuments on land. That's something that's been done. A few of those have been declared in recent months. We may see, you know, more of those types of designations. The Energy Department actually just today came out with a loan guarantee for a carbon capture project down in Louisiana. This is the first time actually they've given loan guarantee money that's designed for clean energy projects specifically to a fossil energy program. The idea is to, you know, figure out ways to capture carbon dioxide, use that for enhanced oil recovery. That's been something that's been a big priority of Obama's Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz. So, you know, they're trying to still not say, you know, no fossil fuel at all, but at the very least, if we're going to do fossil fuels, we should try and do it in a way that's, you know, better for the climate.
Looking at the big picture now, how does this ban on offshore drilling fit into President Obama's climate legacy as it stands right now?
I mean, it's well within the trajectory that he sort of laid out. The biggest rules, you know, the biggest piece of his climate agenda was the Clean Power Plan, which is the EPA power plant rule. That's currently tied up in court. We may see a decision on that relatively soon. Obviously, the Paris agreement that he and the essentially rest of the world signed on to last year, that's gone into effect. You know, there's some question over how quickly a Trump administration may be able to pull back from that, as the president-elect has talked about doing. Even under, you know, supporting that agreement are the actual rules that are in place, which a Trump administration will certainly go after in a variety of ways, and spending also, you know, money that the United States government sends to nonprofits or other governments or the United Nations as part of the Green Climate Fund. That's something that we'll expect to see a Republican Congress and a Trump administration try and pull back on in the future. So it's, you know, Obama is certainly trying to bolster his legacy and trying to do things like the offshore drilling ban that he thinks can't be as easily undone in the future.
Nick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely, Veronica. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Nick Giuliano, Deputy Energy Editor for Politico, talking about President Obama's executive action yesterday, creating what he calls a permanent ban on offshore gas and oil drilling along the Arctic and Atlantic seaboards. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why there's a lot of room for improvement when it comes to health here in Wisconsin.
Right now, it's time for our weekly check-in on national politics. On this edition, changing attitudes toward Russia after accusations of hacking, a continued postmortem on the election outcomes in Wisconsin and elsewhere, and the final word from the Electoral College.
Harry Enten joins us now. He's senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
The Electoral College met, voted this week, and no surprises, were there?
Well, unless you thought that Martin Sheen was going to have a major effect with his videos try to convince electors to change their votes. No, there were no big surprises. Donald Trump is, at this point, going to be the president of the United States in a little less than a month.
Do you think, I mean, there was an effort by many, including Lawrence Lessig, who we talked to on the show, to try to persuade electors, Trump electors, to vote for someone other than Trump. Did anybody out there, as far as you could tell, really think that was going to happen?
Not anybody who, you know, was actually following the information. Perhaps some people who were dreaming thought it was going to happen. But, you know, they do these types of counts. You know, we've been following along, talking to electors, or people in the press have been, and there was just no real sign. And keep in mind, these are Republican electors. It's not like they're Democratic electors who then said that they were going to vote for Trump. These were Republican electors elected on Republican slates. So the idea that they weren't going to vote for the Republican nominee just struck me as foolish.
All told, how many electors did not vote for the candidate they were elected to vote for?
Well, this is the amazing thing, right? It ends up being 7. And in fact, the vast majority of those were people who said they were going to vote for Clinton, but then in fact voted for some other candidates. Bernie Sanders got a vote. Colin Powell got 3 in Washington. Faith Spotted Eagle, who is an American Indian, got 1 vote in the state of Washington. Only 2 Trump electors, both in the state of Texas, decided to go another direction. One cast their vote for John Kasich, who's still somehow around, and the other actually cast his vote for Ron Paul, who obviously is the former congressman from Texas.
That's election 2016. Well, let's get to Russia next and American attitudes to it, as intelligence agencies say Russian hackers aim to influence the election. A bipartisan group of senators wants an investigation. They say both parties should be on board. Senate Majority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell said he agrees.
I agree with Senator Schumer, Chairman McCain, Burr, and others. This simply cannot be a partisan issue.
So this shouldn't be a partisan issue, but you co-wrote a piece on maybe a growing partisan divide in how we think about Russia. What are you seeing?
Well, this is the amazing thing. If you go back through history, Russia has tended to be an issue where Republicans and Democrats agree how they feel about Russia, going all the way back to the 8 times when it was the Soviet Union, all the way back since 1974. But in fact, what we have seen in the past few months is that Republicans are starting to see Russia more as an ally or a friend than Democrats are, which shouldn't be too surprising given that Donald Trump has obviously said some nice things about Russia and its leader Vladimir Putin. So this to me strikes me as yet another example of an issue that used to be bipartisan becoming simply put partisan, because elected officials, even though you do hear some Republicans obviously saying they want this joint investigation, Donald Trump has been is now the leader of the Republican Party, and he has been much more friendly towards Russia than we're used to Republicans being.
Do we see presidents being able to shape public, or president-elects in this case, being able to shape public opinion like this? People talked about Barack Obama when he spoke out on same-sex marriage. That may have had a big pull on public opinion. Is this something we see often?
Well, in fact, we do see it often, and we especially see it on the issue of Russia. Remember, Barack Obama, you know, he was going to come in and they were going to have new relations with Russia. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, back when she was Secretary of State, actually presented a physical reset button to Russia. And during that time, we saw Americans' opinions towards Russia grow more favorable. So it's definitely something that could happen. And at this point, it does seem, at least among Republicans, Trump being friendly towards Russia is, in fact, pushing more Republicans to like Russia.
But not necessarily Republicans in the U.S. Senate leading prominent committees. Names like John McCain, for example, not happy with this warming toward Russia. Are they going to be isolated among Republicans?
Well, I think that this is going to be an interesting sort of matchup between the U.S. Senate and President Trump. Obviously, John McCain was not a huge fan of Donald Trump during the presidential campaign. Donald Trump, likewise, wasn't really a big fan of John McCain. There are a number of senators, and we've sort of ranked them of who we think are the most and least likely to be friendly towards the Trump agenda. And there are a number of names like Lindsey Graham, John McCain, even Marco Rubio, who perhaps won't be as friendly towards Trump. It's going to be interesting to see how many end up in the Senate. Republicans are really allies of Trump, and whether or not Republicans nationwide start perhaps agreeing with Republican lawmakers in the Senate that maybe Trump is a little too friendly towards Russia and perhaps, you know, just not like him as much overall.
With this in mind, a Secretary of State appointee, Rex Tillerson, head of ExxonMobil, done a lot of business with Russia, won an award from Vladimir Putin, Order of Friendship with Russia. Is this Trump saying, hey, we're working with Russia, like it or not?
Yeah, I mean, this to me is sort of a very interesting thing that's going to be the first inclination as to whether or not Republican senators are going to really get aboard the Trump train. There's going to obviously be a vote on whether Rex Tillerson should be the Secretary of State or not. I'm not sure that Trump is going to really be able to get many Democrats, and there are only 52 Republicans in the Senate. So if he loses three Republican senators, that nomination is sunk. And it seems to me that they very well might get those votes. But again, Tillerson hasn't gone through the confirmation hearing yet, so we'll have to wait and see.
People are watching Donald Trump's favorability ratings. What has happened since the election, and where does he stack up compared to previous presidents-elect?
Well, he has seen his favorability rise. I'm not quite sure it could have really fallen much further than it was. And usually we do see when people are elected for a second term or become the president-elect that their favorabilities do rise. But keep in mind, more people still have an unfavorable view than favorable view of Donald Trump. It depends on the exact poll you're looking at. Sometimes the net favorability is somewhere -5. Sometimes it's closer to -15. I've even seen one that was -20. And in terms of history, that is by far, any of those numbers are by far the lowest net favorability rating for any incoming president. It's a good 15 to 20 points below what we're used to seeing, even on the lower end of the spectrum. So Donald Trump, despite winning the presidency and despite winning the president-elect, being the president-elect, is still very much unliked by most Americans.
What does that mean for how a president comes into office and governs? Or is this uncharted territory? We don't know.
Well, I mean, it is uncharted territory. We don't necessarily know when someone is this disliked. What we do know is that the net favorability ratings at this point in time do match up fairly well to how popular they are when they enter the office of the presidency, and does a pretty good job of understanding what the honeymoon period is going to look like. And if that's the case, then Donald Trump is maybe probably going to have more people like him than not like him once he's inaugurated, but by not by that big of a margin. And what does that mean? Well, that tends to perhaps suggest that members of Congress, we do know through political science research, that members of Congress are less likely to go along with the agenda of the President of the United States, especially on larger issues. And indeed, I think you kind of already see that with Russia and Rex Tillerson, where Republican senators are more likely and more open with their disagreements with the President. So if President Trump, or future to be President Trump, ends up being as unpopular as the numbers suggest he will be now, he may have a harder time passing his agenda.
Talking about the week in national politics with Harry Enten from 538. Harry, people still trying to figure out what happened on Election Day, a big post-election question close to home. Why did Trump win Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania? And Democrats are really asking, how did Hillary Clinton lose Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania? You've written recently that there's some long-term trends at work here. It may not just be Hillary Clinton.
Right, yeah. I mean, look, I think that there was an interesting thing going on with Donald Trump running a more populist campaign and Hillary Clinton perhaps being a less of a working-class candidate than we're used to seeing among Democratic nominees for president. But it should be pointed out that President Obama's approval rating in the states, the Midwestern states that ended up being key, dropped significantly more than it did nationwide over the course of his second term in office. And even when it rose, I don't believe it rose as high in those Midwestern states as it did nationally speaking. That is, there was a trend towards the Midwestern states becoming more Republican-leaning even before Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump became the nominees of their party.
Also, we've seen in the last week a Politico piece looking at Michigan, a Daily Beast piece looking at all three states, talking to Democrats, some Bernie Sanders supporters, some local organizers saying, we were trying to sound the alarm to the Clinton campaign, to the team in Brooklyn, that we're going to be underperforming here. We're worried about turnout, the Democratic activists saying, and they didn't listen. Do you think there is something to that, that Hillary Clinton and her people should have heeded those warnings?
Well, I will say this much. You know, in Michigan, for instance, the final margin was about 10,000 votes. Yeah, anything could have happened that could have changed that margin. It's a very, very small margin. In the state of Wisconsin, for sure, Hillary Clinton should have campaigned there more instead of, say, campaigning in Iowa, where she ended up losing by nearly 10 percentage points. But let me offer you this. In the state of Pennsylvania, which was one of the critical states that Hillary Clinton lost by about the same margin she lost Wisconsin by in terms of percentage points, she visited that state a heck of a lot. She put a lot of money into that state on television ads, on internet ads, on radio ads, and she ended up losing it despite all of that effort. So to me, it's, you know, yes, she could have done better in Wisconsin and Michigan to get her message out, but the groundwork was laid long before this election that these states were going to be more competitive and more Republican-friendly than they had been in years past.
A couple other points I wanted to ask you about based on your Twitter feed. North Carolina, big things going on there. They have an incoming, they have a governor-elect from the Democratic Party. The Republican-led legislature and the outgoing Republican governor signed a law to limit the powers of the governor in that state. This has gotten a lot of outcry in North Carolina, some elsewhere. Is this something we should be paying attention to?
I think it should. You know, I think that there are a few things. Number one, it should be pointed out that there's a long history when governors are leaving office that they try and switch the power, how much power the actual governor has. So, you know, there's some normal political fighting that's going on. But we do know that, for instance, there are nonpartisan or supposedly nonpartisan election boards in the state of North Carolina that help run the election process there. And normally speaking, you have more members of the governor's party on those boards than not of the governor's party, and they've changed that a little bit. They've made it even. And usually the governor's party leads the election board in election years, every even year. So, you know, when you'd expect Senate races or governor's races or presidential races. And the way that they've rewritten the rules is they've made it so that the non-governor's party leads those boards during election years, which is so ridiculous and is a complete, in my mind, a political play that is pretty much unprecedented. So I think you have both unprecedented and precedented things happening in the state of North Carolina, but there's certainly more than the normal political play that Republicans have been going at in that state.
Finally, Harry, you are politics and sports fans at 538. You were speculating on the political makeup of NFL cities, trying to figure out the reddest NFL city. What conclusion did you come to?
I believe that the reddest NFL season is probably the city of Jacksonville, which some helpful tweeter we were able to figure out that Jacksonville barely went for Hillary Clinton this campaign, maybe by just about a few thousand votes. I think the other closest city was probably Green Bay up to the north. And although Brown County was won by Donald Trump, Green Bay itself was won by Hillary Clinton by about 3 percentage points. So Jacksonville is the reddest city that has an NFL team in it.
We'll leave it there for now, Harry. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst at 538.com.
Coming up after the news, we'll learn how healthy Wisconsin is by looking at the latest scores on the state's health report card. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, about a quarter of Wisconsin's school districts say they're having trouble hiring teachers. We'll find out what's behind Wisconsin's teacher shortage.
First, researchers at the UW Population Health Institute gave the state a B- on Wisconsin's 2016 health report card. It's a passing grade for the overall population, but a closer look at the numbers show health inequalities across the state and that some groups have more health problems than others.
David Kinding joins us now. He's Professor Emeritus of Population Health Sciences. He founded the Institute of Medicine Roundtable on Population Health Improvement. Dr. Kinding, welcome to Central Time.
And thanks for having me.
Well, we're going to dig into some of the disparities in health, but big picture, can you put that B minus into context for us? How does that compare to years past here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, actually, we've been doing this we do this work at the Population Health Institute, sort of funded by our partnership program, and we've done four of these report cards now every 3 years, starting in 2007. And actually, sort of the bad news is that we've sort of been steady at B minus for overall health and worse grades down in the C and D for our health disparities. It doesn't mean that some of those things are getting better, like in general, the length of our lives in general are improving, but we measure ourselves in comparison to all the other states, and many other states are improving better faster than us. So that's why we've sort of stayed the same over this period, which is obviously discouraging because we put lots of resources into healthcare and public health.
As I understand it, Wisconsin has been as high as sixth healthiest in the nation by national standards. Where are we now? What has changed?
Right. Actually, there is a similar kind of a report like this that comes out for all the states across the country. It actually was, we released ours at the same time. And we were actually last year, they do that every year, last year we were 24th. We've crept down from sixth or seventh a decade ago. Last year we were 24th. We went up to 20th this year, so that's good news. But actually, movement in a couple of those ranks, you know, may not be that make that much difference. So we're down below where we'd like to be, below Minnesota and North Dakota and some of the places that we emulate and certainly think we should be doing as well as.
To sum up what you're measuring in this report, as I understand it, we're looking at quantity of life, how long we live, but also quality, how healthy we are while we're living. Do I have that right?
That's correct. We use half, and if in this particular report, we do the grades based on both of those things. The life years are the mortality rates at different ages, you know, for kids or older people. But the other half, it's called something called unhealthy days. It's a measure that comes out of the CDC, and essentially they ask people in a survey, lots of Wisconsin residents, how many days in the last 30 days were you unhealthy, either for physical health or mental health reasons? And so that's our measure of how healthy you are given the year of life that you're in. And we blend those together into a single grade.
Talking to Dr. David Kindig about a new report card on Wisconsin's health. Let's get into these disparities now, because as I go through this report, and you point this out in the summaries of the report, there are groups that do way, way worse on almost every measure I looked at. I want to start, first of all, with minority populations, African Americans and Native Americans across the board. It seems like their report card looks a lot worse.
Well, it is. And that's nothing, unfortunately, that's nothing new. It's been that way, you know, for a long time. But we find in almost every measure of both the length of life and the quality of life, you know, really unacceptable low grades for Native American and African American citizens. I have to tell you, though, that almost as bad on disparities are those people with, say, less than high school education. They have bad performance across all kinds of health measures as well. Education is the measure we use in this particular report to talk about disparities, socioeconomic disparities, as opposed to racial and ethnic ones. And of course, many racial and ethnic minorities also are lower income or have lower education rates. But for those whites with low education or low income, they're not doing so well either.
Right. That's the other striking thing about this report. It looks like a big health penalty for people at high school education or lower. So this is kind of a marker, as you say, of socioeconomic status, maybe. What are some of the causes, maybe hopefully, that we could fix behind that particular disparity?
Sure. Well, so our Population Health Institute has sort of, over the last 20 years, I mean, we've worked off of and gotten, frankly, famous for a model of producing population health that talks about four kinds of factors: clinical care, health behaviors, social and economic factors like education and income, and the physical environment. And it's a balance of all of those things. Actually, in our particular model, we actually rank the social factors like education and income and social support and behaviors as having the highest weight in producing, you know, outcomes overall. So, I mean, it makes it a very complicated picture, unfortunately. And it kind of means that we have to work on all of those things. But some of those are within our means. I mean, everyone wants, you don't have to be a health care person to, yeah, you can be a business person and say we need better educated kids entering the workforce. We need, living family wage, better jobs. I mean, that's an important part of the problem, but it's not the only part. We've got to have access to clinical care and affordable clinical care, and we have to all work on our health behaviors of smoking and drinking and the things we know about, and we have to protect our physical environment, air quality, water quality, our housing stock. So it's all of those things going together.
So those groups on the downside of this report card, minority populations, African Americans and Native Americans in particular, lower income maybe populations as represented by the people with lower health quality, they could be facing a quadruple whammy. Maybe they have less access to accessible health care. They can't afford it. Worse educational opportunities, low income, and health behaviors, maybe disparities there. They could be facing all four of those problems at the same time.
That's exactly correct. I mean, you've got it. And it's a complicated picture, but it's the true picture and how it works. I mean, one thing, let me just take this moment to make the point that a lot of people seem to focus these days. I mean, the good news is that the health behaviors word is out there, and people are understanding that physical activity and nutrition and obesity and tobacco use and alcohol use, these are important health factors. You know, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, you know, maybe smoking, but those weren't so well appreciated. But sometimes people think that that's just sort of a, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and don't do it. And I mean, of course, we all have to watch our helpings at Christmas and Thanksgiving dinner, but particularly with people with lower education, with you know, lower income, these choices are hard. I mean, we talk about making the healthy choice an easy choice, and some of that, you know, then so those things are tied together. We can't get one without working on the other in many cases.
Let's get into that physical environment part of things, because I can imagine someone with low income might not be able to afford to live a place with good water. So they might have a higher lead in their water or the paint in their buildings. They might be in a more polluted place. Are these the kind of things we talk about with the physical environment? Oh, less access to exercise outside, too, for that matter?
Yeah, that's right. All of those things. And actually, and when we look at us, this particular report that you're looking at, our report card, doesn't deal with those causal factors. But say in the one that just came out that I mentioned across the country, we rank, again, 23rd in the country across those environmental factors, which do include air pollution and violent crime and occupational facilities, you know, some of those kinds of things. So they're very much in the picture.
If there was, so looking at this report and then the factors you consider that underlie these findings, magic wand, you can do one thing to target these groups who are getting F's and D's on the report card. What is the one intervention that you'd like to see happen, and who would have to take the lead on it?
Well, everybody wants to know what's the silver bullet.
Well, not a big first step.
Okay. So actually for me, I mean, you can't say that any of these things are not important. Mm-hmm. But for me, and actually I'm a former pediatrician, more and more people are impressed with the first 3 years of life, or the first 1,000 days they talk about, and how so much is set for the future in terms of your brain development, in terms of your ability to get educated, to get a job, to even to have the benefits of medical care. So not only just the infant deaths that need to be prevented. I mean, those are shocking statistics. But even through the first couple years of life, with early childhood preparation and education and stimulation and good health care, I mean, I think if you said I only could put a dollar into one thing, I would. And actually, interestingly, it's one of the few places where there's relatively decent return on investment data for those kinds of early year investments, not just in overall social outcomes, but in health outcomes as well.
We're talking to Dr. David Kindig, Professor Emeritus of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison, looking at the state's health report card and the health gaps between different groups in Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of Wisconsin's score on the state health report card? Do you see health health in your community getting better or maybe getting worse? Have you seen any of these health disparities firsthand in your life? Are there health issues that you think need more attention? Our number is 800-642-1234.
And if you see this kind of early child health intervention going on in your community that Dr. Kindig was just talking about, love to hear about that too at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Dr. David Kindig, Professor Emeritus of Population Health Sciences, talking about the state's health report card, which shows that Wisconsin has room for improvement and some major disparities, depending on who you're looking at.
You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of Wisconsin's grade on the state health report card? What health issues in the state do you think need more attention and which need it the most? And tell us if you see the health of your community getting better, worse, or maybe staying about the same. Do you see the health inequalities that we've been talking about where you live? You can call us at 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers. Jonathan is with us in Madison. Jonathan, hi.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jonathan?
I guess what I wanted to bring up is I think that education at a young age is really important. I grew up, I'd say for the first 18 years of my life, I was obese. And I overcame that after I graduated high school, and I think that the biggest thing for me was getting educated, and I wish I would have gotten better education in school and also from my parents, because growing up, both my parents have high school educations, and that's kind of where their education ended. And I just found that it was really important for me later on in life that I was educated about how to eat and all of that.
Jonathan, thanks so much for the call. Dr. Kindig, health education at an early age, not just in schools, he's saying, but from parents as well.
Oh, absolutely. And, you asked me for the number one thing, and that's what I said. And so he just reinforces that. You know, another thing about education, I mean, everything that we're talking about investing in, you know, it takes money in a resource-starved world. I mean, healthcare, schools, environmental programs, whatever. I think that education is an investment that actually crosses party lines and crosses, liberal people as well as business people, you know, understand that in order to have a healthy community where there's well-educated workers, you know, where there's people with jobs that can buy things. I mean, so I think that's a place where we can come together, even though on some other things, we might have some political differences.
Jonathan, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Kindig, you used the phrase return on investment earlier, referring in particular to early child health care and education.
Right.
Is this a case where maybe we pay a little bit now at those early ages and face lower health care costs down the road?
Yes, I think it actually is true. I mean, it's really hard research to do to get these kinds of things done. But actually, in this particular field, a Nobel laureate in economics from Chicago, University of Chicago, James Heckman, has done groundbreaking work on the multiplier effect that those early investments have, not only in healthcare and healthcare costs, but for the society in general. So that's really well-established work that we can all build on.
I want to get into one of the factors kind of behind these numbers again. One of the ones you mentioned is healthcare access.
Yep.
Obviously a huge political issue in the United States, not just availability of doctors, but affordability of healthcare services. What would you want to see there, acknowledging that this is a huge issue?
No, well, absolutely. But it's one of the four determinants, actually. In our model, we actually think that the behaviors and the social factors are slightly more important even than clinical care. But clinical care is obviously important. So, people have to have insurance coverage. They have to have it where that they can afford it. It has to cover the kinds of things that are needed, and people have to have providers that they can reach to utilize it. So, we've made progress over the years on that. I've been involved in that kind of policy my whole career for 40 or 50 years. But it continues to be an issue and a struggle, as you know. So, but we, you know, we have to, no, there's, we're not going to, even if we say it may not be the most important thing, it's critical and it's got to be in place and everybody has to have it.
We are talking about the health of Wisconsin, a new report card out. Dr. David Kendig is with us. He's involved in this report, Professor Emeritus of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison. B- is the overall grade, but that maybe hides some real disparities, the report says. Some minority groups, African Americans, Native Americans, much lower results, and people at lower education levels, maybe lower socioeconomic levels, see a much worse health outlook. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. And Dr. Kendig, I don't know if this new report card would mention of that, this, but we've talked to your colleague, Dr. Patrick Remington, about a couple factors lowering what was once a growing lifespan. Obesity, a big one, and also worries about opioid prescription epidemics in certain populations. Is that something you think is showing up in this report card?
Report card, yeah, I mean, we don't measure those factors specifically, although actually we have a whole companion product here called County Health Rankings, where and Dr. Remington and I and other colleagues have been involved with that over the last decade, where we actually rank the health of every county in the country, and not only the outcomes, but you can actually go into it and look at how every county in Wisconsin compares across the country on any of these things like tobacco rates and obesity. I don't think we have opioid stuff in their deaths yet, but yes, I mean, those are growing trends that that point things in the wrong direction. And actually, just I think 2 weeks ago there was a national study thinking that showing that it may be for the first time life expectancy might not be increasing every year. In the past, every, I mean, it varies in different states and whatever, but every you know, we get a little bit longer life every year, both for men and women, and there's some indication that that has at least flattened out right now, which is really shocking in the U.S. history of this stuff, and possibly could even be going down. And some people are saying it could be obesity or it could be some of these opioid deaths that are contributing to that, along with other things as well.
That reminds you, your report also broke things down by age group.
Sure.
What stood out to you there?
Yeah, well, we just look at it in every age group, and you know, we always worry a lot about kids. I mean, infants who are in Milwaukee or who are minority or have parents with lower education, older adults, male older adults didn't do as well as some other age groups. So, yeah, it's across the lifespan that we have to worry about this.
Let's bring on another caller now. We've got Isaac with us in Appleton. Isaac, hi.
Hey, my question was just real quick to the nature of the study. You said it was by word of mouth or like not word of mouth, but you asked them how they felt. Do you think that some people in poor communities feel less healthy than other people, and so they would say they're less healthy?
Yeah, well, that's a great comment. That's a great question. On the methods, it's actually a national survey that comes out of, so it's a telephone survey that comes out of the CDC. I mean, they do, so that's always something you have to worry about. I mean, it's a very perceptive question, and good for you for worrying about the methods. When they ask the question, how many days in the last 30, you know, were you unhealthy physically and mentally, and we add those up, it gets a little more precise. I mean, it's not exactly, are you just feeling bad? It's how many days, I mean, we didn't say, couldn't you go to work or couldn't you get up and about, but that's the implication of it. So the people that do that national study, you know, feel better about that, but you make a good point, and what we know is only as perfect as the data that we gather in, and sometimes there are limitations of it.
Thanks a lot for the call, Isaac. As we wrap up, Dr. Kendig, what do you help people do with these report cards that come out every 3 years?
Right. Well, not specifically with this three-year report card, I mean, we want to use it to motivate local community groups, hospitals, United Ways, you know, to action in all of these areas. But
as I mentioned, we have this companion county health rankings program right here in the same floor where I'm speaking from, and they actually have a team of coaches, 11 people on our staff, who actually reach out to people across the state and around the country when they say, look at this on our report card. What can we do about it? This is the thing we want to work on. So there's quite a bit of expertise here in helping people try to take action, you know, working with local public health and with local providers and other community groups to try to improve. That's what this is all about. It's about getting healthier.
Dr. Kindig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dr. David Kindig, Professor Emeritus of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison. He founded the Institute of Medicine Roundtable on Population Health Improvement. He was with us there to talk about a new report card on the health of Wisconsin in 2016. You can find a link to some info about that report card and share your thoughts on health initiatives in your community over at the Central Time Facebook page.
A box without hinges, key, or lid, yet golden treasure inside is hid.
That's Bilbo Baggins in the first Hobbit movie laying out a riddle about a hidden treasure.
And there's a new treasure here in Wisconsin. Marquette University announced that they're getting a rare edition of Tolkien's fantasy classic, The Hobbit.
The newest addition to Marquette's J.R.R. Tolkien collection is a first edition first printing of The Hobbit. It's one of only 1,500 copies in the world.
The Hobbit was originally published in 1937, and it sold out before the year was up.
Marquette has a pretty big Tolkien collection with over 1,200 items, including books, drawings, and documentaries, along with some drafts and pre-publication versions of stories, including one draft where it turns out the whole Lord of the Rings story was a dream the whole time.
No.
I made that one up. Sorry.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. I haven't looked at them all. We're going to talk to somebody from that collection. Would you want a first edition Hobbit?
I'd rather have a first edition Lord of the Rings, but yeah, I wouldn't turn up my nose at that, would you?
No, probably not. That's one, I don't know, I'm pretty bad with books I read. They end up with a lot of food stains on them, let's be honest.
This is true. I've borrowed books from you. I can vouch for this.
Well, they come back in worse shape than they start with, but we don't need to get into that.
That is not
Forget
true.
I said anything about
you're gonna
that.
Start
That's a
some,
whole...
You're trying to start something.
More on The Hobbit and Tolkien and Marquette University tomorrow. This is Central Time.